Hello and welcome to Country Stride, the podcast dedicated to the landscapes, people and heritage of Cumbria and the Lake District. I'm here today on a blustery, cold and slightly grey day above the meadows and the village of Burneyside in the company of author, illustrator and our guide for today's walk, Mark Richards. Hello, Mark.
Hello, David. I've got daffodils at my feet. Even they are cowering against the breeze that is pretty cutting.
Yeah, still plenty of winter holding on to this neck of Cumbria. We've not been down here before, Mark. So as I say, just above Burneyside, looking down over Kendal, we've got a few of the fells around. Still a little bit of snow around, particularly on the highest fells of the Lake District. We're here today, Mark, to talk about a business, to talk about a family, and to talk about a landscape. Tied in with this, it's the River Kent and the historic industries that have emerged from that great watercourse. What are we talking about today, Mark, and who is our guest?
The Cropper family, and it's Mark Cropper who is our guest today, who's the chair of the company, but it's a company that has been here for six generations and has established itself, but is always looking forward. There were mills in this valley going back to the early medieval times, but this is still a business built on the river, close to Kendal, an industrial but nonetheless a pastoral, rural and beautiful setting.
Yeah, so we've got a lot to get through today. We're going to go back in time. We're going to talk about the history of the river and those mills, as you say, and we're going to bring it right up to the present day. I'm sure many listeners will know of James Cropper and its involvement with printing the poppy, but it's also involved with some really cutting edge technologies. They do some great stuff, taking plastic out of coffee cups that we all think are recyclable. Well, they're not really, unless you take out this plastic. So they're doing some really incredible things. The other incredible thing that Mark Cropper's involved with is if you drive along the A591, Mark, from the M6 up into Windermere, you might have seen over the past couple of years a lot of tree guards emerging onto the hills around here. They're creating a huge expanse of wood pasture coupled with an incredible number of wildflower meadows. So they're really revolutionising the landscape around here in a wildlife-friendly way. A lot of regenerative farming coming into being here. So really looking forward to this.
I love the notion of a business that actually is part of the landscape.
Well, I believe we're going to go meet Mark upstream of Cowan Head, so let's go and find him now. I'm going to put my gloves on and we'll start our wander downstream along the Dales Way.
What a wonderful day. This billowing cloud above us. I'm beside the River Kent. There's crocus out, a few daffodils out. I can hear ducks. I can see on the far hill the sunlight dappling with a flock of sheep. But far more significantly is a very important story connected with this river and the power that it engendered. And to tell us today the story of croppers, I have got the chair of this business, Mark Cropper, with me today. Wonderful to see you, Mark, and thank you for joining Country Stride. It'd be wonderful if you could tell us something about your family roots and the business itself.
Yeah, well, I'm thrilled to be with you, and actually it's a nice morning, all the better. So my family, direct family, we've been here since 1845, and in fact where we're standing is only a few yards away from where the family first lived when they came. But in fact I've got 10 generations of heritage on the River Kent, because the Croppers were Quakers, and for two generations in the 1820s and 40s, they married into another Quaker family from Kendal called the Wakefields. And that's what brought us here and into industry, into papermaking and a lot more.
And for those listeners who may not know what Croppers papermaking business is, could you just explain it in round terms?
Just for the business itself, we make anything from traditional papers. For instance, the imitation book cloth on every hardback book is made in Burneside, just to the north of Kendal, right through to the lightest weight carbon fibre papers in the world that go into the production of green hydrogen in 80% of all commercial composite aircraft and everything in between. And in doing that, we employ about 600 people. We're the largest employer in this part of the county. And frankly, in order to keep it going, we're constantly thinking of what we can do better, how we can lower our impact, because we think the more sustainable we are in a green sense, the more sustainable the business will be, and so on.
Well, today you're going to give us a journey on foot from the old to the new. Can you just outline where we're going?
Yeah, well, we're going to start where the paper making story starts, and then we're going to walk down the Kent through the different communities. We're going to take a little bit of a side diversion off to a cow shed, or a former cow shed at the back of my house, which is the newest part of the story, in fact. And then we're going to end in our mill looking at anything from the traditional right to the cutting edge.
And we're going to follow a little bit of the Dale's Way in the process. We'll make our first steps on the Dale's Way to Cowan Head. Well, we've come downstream a little bit. We've come to a mill pond where there's a weir and a very substantial conglomeration of modern buildings. We're again beside the River Kent. Can you tell us something about the river and its significance in the story? I know it starts high up on High Street and runs down Kentmere, of course, the dramatic fell setting, but we've come in here into a far more pastoral setting.
The Kent is well known for being the fastest flowing river in England. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but what it does mean is it falls very significantly over a short distance. And all those falls, you know, where it spills over different outcrops of rock, they're all opportunities that have existed for hundreds of years to take a little bit of that water and use it for power and process. Starting in about the 12th century, there are records of over 53 mills here on the Kent.
And what kind of things were these?
Well, there was obviously corn milling, but actually this area, of course, is far more associated with wool. Kendal's motto, panis mihi panis, is wool is my bread, and that tells you more about this area than anything. So here where we are at Cowan Head, there was a woolen mill from about the late 13th century. So I like to think about 1275, because that means that we're going to have our 750th anniversary next year. This was a fulling mill, and what a fulling mill was that after the wool had been, you know, carded, spun, woven in the house or on the farm, it was often very loose. It needed to be shrunk, washed, condensed, as it were, and that's what a fulling mill did. It had these wooden stocks that pound the cloth in a trough. You need water power to power that process, and that industry went right through from the 13th century up to a critical moment in the mid-18th century when things began to change.
So there were 53 mills. Where were they concentrated?
Anything from right up at the top of Kentmere, just below the church, right through down to actually not far above Levens. At Helsington, actually, there was a snuff mill with operational water power machinery, only closed about, I don't know, 25 years ago or so. And there's still, obviously, there's a history of snuff. There still is snuff manufacturer in Kendal. Kendal had massive woolen mills. It had Castle Mills. It had Dockray Hall Mills. It was a really industrial town.
Now, here we are at Cowan Head, and the significant industry or business here was paper manufacture. What was the genesis of that?
In 1746, a Kendal stationer called Thomas Ashburner, who was also a printer, he published a newspaper, one of the earliest actually regional newspapers in the country, and a lot more. He came here and he bought this manorial fulling mill and he turned it into a paper mill.
Was paper being manufactured at that time more generally around the country?
Paper was manufactured everywhere by that stage. It didn't start in England until about 1488, so actually quite late. But there was paper making in Cumbria, places like Ambleside from the beginning of the 17th century. That was probably making very coarse, rough brown paper that was used for wrapping, or we call it packaging nowadays, don't we, for wrapping wool. But what there wasn't a mill that made clean white paper for printing, for writing. And that's what Thomas Ashburner was interested in. So he came here. Obviously, the water is very pure, because not only, obviously, in the paper mill do you use the water for power, you use it for process. It's a tradition that continues right through to today.
So who was buying Thomas Ashburner's paper?
The important thing was an emerging middle class who were getting more and more literate. But it was more than just Kendall. He had links, for instance, with, you know, Kirby Stephen. You could draw a whole ring around. It was the age when pack horse trails were beginning to gradually turn into turnpike roads. Connections were opening up. So actually, he traded very broadly. The other thing that really made a difference to provincial printers and papermakers like Thomas Ashburner was that before 1695, all the printing in England was restricted to London, York, Oxford and Cambridge. And it was only with this Licensing Act changed that, so that provincial printers and obviously provincial consumption could really grow.
Not only newspapers, we are probably talking about the early genesis of books themselves in this area.
Absolutely. Him and his son, who took over from him in about 1770, they published pamphlets, they published books. They were very much part of that whole growth of a provincial book trade.
Now, the croppers have not cropped up. Oh, I have to get one pun in. But there is a story about how the Ashburners became, in effect, the cropper story.
Actually, that starts a mile downstream from here, because almost at the exactly same moment that Thomas Ashburner was building his paper mill here, an individual called Roger Wakefield bought the manorial mills at Burneyside. Now, they traditionally had been used, for wool and corn, but he turned that site into one of the world's very first mechanised woolen mills in 1760, followed not that long after by one of the earliest cotton mills that had Arkwright frames. Now, the connection with the croppers is that in 1820, there was a cropper Wakefield marriage, and in fact, it came with a dowry even of two farms in Burneyside. And then a generation later, my papermaking forebear, who really gives his name to our business, James Cropper, age 17, he fell in love with his first cousin, Fanny Wakefield, from Kendal. The reason he actually moved here and took over this paper business, the Wakefields had wound down their woolen and cotton mills in Burneyside, and they'd leased it to the successor to Ashburner, who by the 1845 was an individual called Cornelius Nicholson. And he sold the pair of mills to James Cropper in 1845. And James Cropper, he was 22 years old, frankly knew nothing about employing people, about trade, about industry. But he came here, and in fact, he came to Cowan Head. He moved into the mill house. It was a very pretty Georgian mill house, I assume Ashburner had built, overlooking this mill pond. And that's where he started our family life.
I believe you've got a poem written locally in 1773. Can you recite that?
Yeah, I'm just going to read this short extract from this poem about these ingenious artists. He's referring to the author William Robinson, is referring to papermakers. This was written about Thomas Ashburner and his mill. In fact, I don't know if there's any other poem in the world about a paper mill. Even while poetry obviously depends upon paper, has depended on paper, I don't think it's often given sort of thanks back to paper. But I just want to read this, just a little excerpt from that poem, because it's very, very nice. And it says, "Ingenious artists, ye who daily make the leaves we write on, may your labours fill with wealth your coffers while you propagate the means to etonise the wise and good."
Well, you've told us a great deal about the bounty of the setting and the way the family have emerged onto this opportunity. And we'll follow the Dales Way a little downstream to build the story ever more. We've come down the stream, not too far, but we've come right beside the River Kent onto a shingle shore, at Bowston. And Mark, this is a lovely spot, but actually this is the site of a mill. But there's nothing there now.
Yeah, there's nothing to see here now. There's been change here even in the last 2 years. So we built another paper mill here. In fact, it was the third, because we had one at Cowanhead, one at Burnside. But then in between where we are now, we built a mill 1870s for preparation of raw materials. That continued until the 1950s, when it was closed and eventually turned into housing. But the weir here that generated the power, we had turbines here, that was only removed by the South Cumbria Rivers Trust about 2 years ago.
So what was the reason that it was removed?
Well, what it was doing is it was actually removing a barrier in the river to fish migration. There was a fish pass here, but it wasn't particularly effective. From my point of view, it was much better to take down an old weir in a controlled fashion than just let nature take its course and then have some sort of event where it was washed away and created a hell of a mess.
By nature, what would be the fish here?
Well, we've got migratory salmon and sea trout. Now, obviously, we know that stocks of those are ever more imperiled, but right in this area, in fact just above the paper mill at Burnside, we have the best spawning ground in the whole of the catchment of the Kent.
So we have James Cropper in 1845. He develops his mill, but the business, well, it's still going now. So there's all those generations thriving, but why is it surviving in this rural outpost?
Yeah, we've been here for a long time, so I'm the sixth generation. And, you know, there's a few reasons. I think one of the first is that, unlike so many mill owners in other places, we're not in a smoky industrial town that you want to leave as soon as you've made a bit of money. We're in, you know, at the heart of the Lake District. We're frankly where the mill owners come to build a villa when they've made their money. So the family have never had grounds to leave. That's a sort of personal family reason, but there's some more practical reasons. And probably the most important, if we're trying to take that line from 1845 actually right up to the 1970s, is the railway. James Cropper, he bought the mills on the 5th of July 1845, and the day before, the man who sold in the mills, he's called Cornelius Nicholson, he cut the sod on the Kendal to Windermere railway, and he was the main promoter of this railway, and it connected the main line at Oxenholme with Windermere. And of course, because he had the paper mill at Burnside before he sold it to James Cropper, he made sure that it went right past the mill at Burnside, and we then built sidings there. What it meant was that this very rural mill, at frankly a time when obviously steam power had really taken over, it had a lifeline. It had a way in and a way out. The coal could come in, but also the goods could get out. We didn't just have a local market. We had a national market. Generation later, we had steamships, so we had an international market, and obviously Empire and all of that. So that was just that critical moment of the railway coming. In fact, it was one of the very first branch lines in the whole country. That's part of that sort of thread that brings us to today.
We talk about William Wordsworth, who was quite anti the railway, although he was a shareholder. But there was a branch line that went to Cowanhead.
Yeah, generation after the railway was built into Burnside and beyond, we built a tram line connecting our three mills by that stage. It was narrow gauge to start off with. And then after the First World War, with tracks seized by General Allenby in Palestine, they were brought back here and we laid a proper railway with a motorised engine that still survives at the Hammerthwaite Museum. And that ran till 1972.
In effect, the stretch we just walked and continues is the Dales Way on the track.
Yeah, and if you follow the route from Cowanhead through Bowston down to Burnside, a lot of that is the track bed.
Well, we'll make a sideways step now to learn about how paper is made. Well, we've walked down the river, but up the hill, and we've come beside a stone barn. But what catches my eye is a royal coat of arms by the appointment of Her Majesty the Queen. Now, what's going on here, Mark?
It's been a really, really enjoyable part of the kind of whole paper story here in Burneyside. And this is actually, this is separate from James Cropper from the Big Mill. This is connected with a charitable foundation that I set up in 2016 called the Paper Foundation. And equally, that came from a project that we initiated with our parish council in 2015 when we thought, what can we do to help our community, to bring more life and soul back to it? You know, so it's one thing to look after a business, but you've got to also look after the places around them and care about them and nurture them. So in that process, we had this vision for Burneyside back in 2015. The author said, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could somehow celebrate paper and your long association with it as a community? That got me looking into what people do to celebrate this remarkable material that's underpinned so much of our culture for centuries across the Western world. And I realised that paper wasn't celebrated. In fact, it was ignored. It sort of just, again, everything about it was just forgotten about in some ways. And equally, the heritage was being discarded. So I started collecting all the artefacts of the trade, particularly actually for making paper by hand, that were just thrown away in old mills, stored them, then realised that the knowledge to use them was very nearly dead. And this coat of arms comes in. This is a royal warrant, and it was awarded to us by Elizabeth II 6 months before she died. And that's because we took over from the last people in the country who could make paper by hand. And they had this warrant because they supplied Windsor Castle. We relocated their equipment here. And the reason we're at home is because we had to find somewhere to put it. And when you make paper, there's lots of water everywhere. You can't put it in a house. You can't. There was no room anywhere else. And this actually is an old mill building. When I was growing up, it was a cow shipping. And we thought, we can do it there. So we started doing that. Individuals, Tom, who you're about to meet, wrote to me, said, look, can I come and do this? So he came beginning of 2020. Mike, our predecessor, came and trained him just before lockdown. And we sort of started the whole process. But 4 years after we started, we are supplying handmade paper all around the world to artists, to conservators, to museums, to libraries, anything from the Library of Congress to the Vatican to the Royal Household and lots in between. We're recycling waste rags back into paper because that was traditionally always a source of fibre. So should we go and have a look?
We'll make a venture inside then, Mark.
Sorry.
It is a bomb.
We've got some machinery in action, so I'll sort of switch that off so we can talk in the back and you can see what's going on.
Okay.
Hi, Sam.
Hi. Fascinating. We've come into the old cow byre on one side of the barn, as Mark was describing it. And we've got some equipment here. And I've got Tom Frith Powell here, who's come up from London to embroil himself in this process. Tom, can you give us a little feel of yourself and what got you into this whole process?
Well, as you say, I moved up from London 4 years ago. At the time, I didn't actually know anything about paper, but my grandparents had lunch with Mark and heard about it at that meal. And they then mentioned to me that he had this project, which I thought was interesting. So I emailed him. We met a few times and then I decided to move up.
Can you describe the process you're going through here to make paper by hand?
Yes, this machine is called a beater, a Hollander beater, and it's about 180 years old, we believe. It's a kind of tub with a rotating wheel in, and under this cover there are some metal bars. And you add the plant fibre to this. In this case, we are recycling cotton bed sheets of a hotel chain, and you add the bed sheets to water and pulp them using the beater, which essentially means they're pounded with water until each fibre is reduced back to its original untwisted plant fibre, and it turns into this kind of slurry-like substance here, which is cotton and water. That's the raw material of the paper making. You then dilute it with water in the vat, which we have over there, and you dip a mould, which is kind of like a flat sieve, into the pulp, lift it out, the water drains away, leaving the mat of fibre on the face of the mould.
Now, Mark, you're standing by this very ancient bit of equipment here that begins the process. Can you describe the actual paper itself, how it emerges from this?
Yeah, so, I mean, as Tom was describing, you break down plant fibre into its constituent sort of strands of cellulose, and the real magic of paper, and it really is that those fibres naturally bond. It's actually a hydrogen bond, to be technical. So when you sieve the paper, almost instantaneously, there's a kind of a matting of that material. There's no binder added, there's no glue. So when you sieve it and then you dry it, that's paper. It's as simple as that. And that is a process that goes right back to China over 2,000 years ago and comes right forward here at the more traditional craft end, but equally it's exactly the same process we have on machine in Burneside in the big mill as well.
Intriguingly, here you're using bed linen, but historically what was used for paper?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, in Europe, but the industry really took off from the kind of late 13th century, it was waste rags. So we're going right back to the beginning here. Now, in those days, it wasn't cotton. Cotton wasn't a fibre that was prevalent in Europe. It was linen. And linen actually makes the most amazing paper because it's got a longer fibre, so it's much stronger, so you can actually therefore make it lighter. In fact, we are making paper regularly out of linen. That changed, actually, for most of the paper industry around the world in the kind of mid-late 19th century. People have dreamed of new fibres for paper, and there was always lots of ideas and trials. But it wasn't until then that people found a way to process wood into pulp, which involves a lot of energy, quite a lot of chemicals, and trees, and wood pulp made from trees has been the main source of fibre for the global paper industry. But in fact, here, obviously, we're going back to the textile waste, and equally, actually, in our big mill, we're doing the same thing. We're going back to waste. We're about 40% waste even down there now. And we started actually with recycled coffee cups. We'll come to that later.
Well, we'll move down to the next machine and we'll have a quick word with Tom again to see what he's actually achieving here. Right, we've got a screen with a frame. Now, what are you doing here in the process?
So this is the mould and deckle. And
it's a deckle?
Yeah. So this wooden frame that fits onto the mould is called the deckle. And as you'll see, when you scoop the fibre and water out, that prevents it from all sliding off the side. And that will become the kind of edge of the sheet. Yeah. In the vat, it's about 99% water to 1% fibre. And the rest of the process really is taking the water out of the sheet until you get a dry sheet. So the water's currently draining away, leaving the mesh of fibre on top, which is the sheet of paper. Once it's dry enough, we can then couch it, which is the next process of transferring
couch.
It. Yeah.
Couching it. Couch is from coucher, the French, and it means basically you're putting it to bed.
So this is quite thick paper we're making here.
Oh, yes.
As you can see, it's going to be a card, a postcard.
And you turn it over and you weigh on it a bit with your body, and that separates it from the frame. And there it lies. How do you describe that, Mark?
It's a perfect rectangle with a kind of slightly rough edge. It's beautiful, kind of creamy white.
Isn't it gorgeous?
And do you know what's amazing about, again, linen paper, is that centuries later, you know, you'll have paper from the Renaissance that is still this beautiful, creamy white. Because it was made, again, with clean water, with basically no chemicals. So it can last forever. And that's one of the great... It's not a mystery of paper, but it's one of its great qualities. Is this material that you can tear and destroy and seemingly so fragile actually can last for centuries.
It's glorious, quite frankly. Tom set it out on that surface. The surface it's on is interesting.
When you couch, when you take the piece of paper off the mould you made it on, you do that onto woolen felts. You then build up a stack of those. So you go piece of paper, felt, piece of paper, up to about 50. In fact, over there in the press, you can see, you call that a post. That's a post of felts and paper. And then we'll apply pressure to that to squeeze the water out more. And of course, the felts in between help the water get out. But also the felt leaves on the paper an impression. And depending on how much you then press it or burnish it, you can have more or less of that impression. So you can create incredible surfaces. And we have a project we've started, but the end is rather a long way away, because we have discovered that the drawing paper used by Leonardo da Vinci and other artists of that era, one of the reasons their drawings are so kind of effervescent and full of light is that in the paper, there's still the original pattern of hair marks from the woolen felts. And the woolen felts in those days were much coarser because they were made from coarser wool. Now, here in the Lake District, we have archaic sheep varieties with coarse fleeces. Clearly. So obviously the Herdwick, but also rough fell. And in fact, the rough fell was a lot more prevalent than people realised. So last summer, I went out and started chatting to farmers. Anyway, we've got 16 wool sacks.
Of Kendal Rough.
Half of Kendal Rough, half of Herdwick. That was the easy bit, because also buying wool, as we know, is
cheap.
Yeah, it's really inexpensive. Processing it is not. So the idea is that we will create a full set of working felt. So we're talking not hundreds of metres, but, you know, a lot of this. You need to obviously card it, spin it, weave it, and then actually felt it afterwards. So there's a whole process that we're going to go down, because we want to make Leonardo's Renaissance drawing paper again, because it's unlike any surface that any artist has had for hundreds of years.
Now, you've been at this, Tom, for about 4 years. What do you love about it?
When you're actually making the paper, as you might hear on the podcast, the sound of the water, it's quite a gentle process, and you're there with the vat, and it just kind of trickles away in the morning.
I think what's fascinated me here is I started rescue equipment because I didn't want it to go into a skip or be discarded. We then thought we must rescue the knowledge. Tom and I have been blown away by the global interest we've had. And we're having people coming here from, you know, other continents, all around the world, basically saying, you're the only people we can find in the world to do this. And that's quite humbling because, you know, we're kind of in a cow shipping at the back of an old farm building in rural old Lake District. And yet we've got something that is relevant to, you know, in a very small niche, to people all around the world. Again, I think it, for me, it really confirms how important it is to bring crafts like this back from extinction, because there is demand out there and interest. And we haven't spoken to Sam and Johnny, our two apprentices who are working with Tom, but when we advertised for applicants for those roles, we had over 80 applicants for each role.
Well, from the craft end of the market, which is very unique, we're going to go and find something else that is unique, the leading edge of croppers down in the factory in the village. Fascinating. We've come from the artisan crafting of paper to a completely different realm of croppers. Mark, please introduce me to the sounds and the sights before me.
Yeah, so we're in the heart of our Burneyside Mills site now. It's about 25 acres. We've got a lot of different things going on here. So, of course, originally, 200 years ago, paper was made here by hand. But by the time James Cropper bought it, it was machines. We still have paper machines making traditional papers here. So we make anything from the red paper for the poppies right through to the imitation book cloth on every hardback book, all the picture mount board that you all frame your pictures with. Where we're standing right now is one of our newest initiatives. We heard and talked about paper being made by hand and sieving a slurry of pulp and squeezing the water out. What we're actually doing here, in fact, you can hear the kind of the presses in the back. We are moulding that paper pulp into three-dimensional shapes. And I'm holding here, it's a champagne bottle, empty, I might add. And it's wrapped in a very lightweight piece of moulded paper, embossed actually with the pattern of the chalk cellar walls of the Champagne House in Champagne. This is all moulded in one, effectively, sheet. It's one piece. And what's important about this is it's fully recyclable. But more importantly, this is 9 times lighter with a 60% lower carbon footprint from the box that came before it. It's a step in the right direction in terms of impacts.
Now, you mentioned right at the top of that little piece there about the poppies for Armistice Day.
We've been working with the Royal British Legion since 1978. Actually, prior to 78, it wasn't a paper poppy. I think it was plastic. So they came to us And we developed this poppy paper. Now, everybody thinks red piece of paper, so what? But what you don't realise is that that piece of paper, it mustn't fade, it mustn't bleed. You know, so it has a lot of technical properties in the paper. Last year, with third-party designers, we've always made the green leaf, but we're now making the stem as well. All of the plastic has been designed out of the poppy, and that's all made here and has been made here since 1978.
Amazing, we've come into a new factory space, a very tall building with enormous equipment in it, little sanctuaries for staff to operate in. It's a different sound. What am I witnessing, Mark?
In some ways, you're seeing a paper machine, but a paper machine like no other. We've got four of them in here, and they're the only ones in existence.
In the world?
In the world, and I'm saying that because we invented them. In fact, we're looking at carbon fibre paper coming off this machine, being reeled up into a reel. And how this happened is 40 years ago, one of our directors, incredibly creative guy, he sat next to someone on an aeroplane who'd got a grant to build a carbon fibre factory. And it's a little bit like graphene is now, this new wonder material. And he thought, could we make paper from it? And he and another director went off to the lab by themselves at night. And unlike paper, which naturally bonds, carbon fibre didn't. So they had to find a way to bind it. They did. They made a sheet. And it has all these incredible properties. So this material, it can conduct, it can insulate, it can carry adhesive or paint. So just to give you an example of where it's used on the bonnet of a Lamborghini to have a grade-age finish that's more aerodynamic. It's used in wind turbine blades and commercial aircraft to conduct lightning strikes. It's used in batteries to dissipate heat. It's used in fuel cells and hydrogen as a kind of electrode substrate to conduct. It's a radical departure, and has been for us, and thank God for us, because actually this is the business that really is growing. It's more profitable. We're very, very differentiated. But it does have its root in the craft. I'm holding here just a sample of paper. Now, copy paper that we all use is 80 grams per square meter. This is 2, and it's so light it can actually float on the heat coming off my hand.
Many of our listeners will be aware, perhaps, that croppers have been involved with the creation of recyclable coffee cups.
Well, this is about the recycling of coffee cups. So we have been interested for a long time in alternative fibres for paper making. And we discovered that coffee cups are 98% really good quality paper, 2% plastic. And we spent 4 years and about 5 million developing a sequence of processes to get the plastic off and recover the paper fibre and reuse it. And that's still running to the day. So about 20% of the fibre we use in our paper business comes from coffee cups now. And we've recycled, since we started, we've recycled the equivalent of 5 billion cups.
Well, you've given us these two fascinating processes. We'll go back up the hill and reflect on the whole setup and look at a bit of nature as well while we're at it. Wow, it's one heck of a breeze that's carried us up the hill from the factory and the village of Burneside. And I'm now at the brow, looking down the pastures, down actually onto the cricket ground, and I can see Benson Knot rising to the east of us. And through the trees, I can just see the factory, the mill buildings that we've just vacated. But there's more, because it's in this natural setting that we're here. And if you've come off the motorway and you're heading to the lakes, you will perhaps have seen tree guards, things happening in the pastures here that emphasise that Mark Cropper is a man on a mission. What's that mission, Mark?
Yeah, the family's been here for a long time. And just by virtue of kind of being here, we gradually bought up, you know, land and farms throughout the kind of 19th century that we still manage today. And I think, like a business, like a community, these things always have to be thought about. What do we need to change it to make our land, our farmsteads, you know, and the communities that they support more resilient, particularly in, you know, in an age of climate volatility, which frankly it's upon us already. We've had terrible storms, huge tree losses around here, floods, but there are things we can do. We formulated a vision for how we might manage land differently. We've put about 1,500 acres into stewardship, of which 1,200 acres were creating wood pasture. So it's still farming, it's still grazed by cattle, not sheep, less intensively. We're also leading on 300 acres of wildflower meadow restoration, which I believe is about the biggest in the country. The scale of that hay meadow restoration came from the fact that I'm really, really want us to keep farming, but equally importantly, preserve this amazing kind of cultural landscape, the patchwork. It's not just about one use, you know, the wildflower meadow restoration, but also we've kept land out of the scheme, so we're planting up to 100 acres of orchards. We're just actually starting a veg box growing scheme with a partner, Vista Veg. They're going to be drilling the ground in a few weeks' time. We're really, really keen that while we actually probably have fewer animals being raised on the estate, we also still feed people. So we're looking at how we grow calories in other ways. We're also looking about how we grow fibres. Flax, for instance, that could be for paper making, but equally, let's bring more of these crafts back to this area. Let's grow a greater diversity of things again, but also make things out of them locally again. Let's relocalise what we do. We need to do that. And the experience I've had with the Paper Foundation and bringing back that craft from extinction, let's do it again. And it all knits together, because ultimately we need really vibrant human ecosystems alongside natural ecosystems. If we can get this balance right, we're going to sustain a community here that also supports our business and everything else we do. So we've got to join the dots again. I think that's what we've lost in, I guess, recent decades of globalised capitalism.
Something else that you are personally engaged in and in a collective way is this new initiative, the Penrith to Kendal Landscape Corridor. What's all that about?
Yeah, so this again is a big idea, a local idea. And if we go back, I mean, I think it was only about 18 months ago, I was sitting down here, just here in my office with Lee Schofield of Wildfell and RSB Horsewater fame.
And Country Stride fame.
We were talking about what he's doing up at Horsewater. We were talking about what Lowther are doing. And then I was also introducing him to what we were doing here, which was only just starting. And I said, why don't we try and join the dots here and create a wildlife corridor from Kendal to Penrith? And it just lit a fuse somehow. And I have to say, I take zero credit for this. This has been picked up by Lee and others, and, you know, not least Lowther. And again, I'm very lucky to work with a friend here, Phil Davis, who sort of got out there, brought people together. And actually, we brought something like 40 farmers and landowners together, 50,000 acres, and we put in for this landscape recovery funding bid. This is funding to kind of work up the scheme, as it were, and we were successful.
Brilliant.
So this project is now being pulled together, and very importantly, we all can do things locally, but we need to join the dots and make it really big. So hopefully it's going to make sure that we still have our insects and our bird life and, frankly, our food as well.
Well, it's wonderful to stand in this majestic setting with you, Mark, in front of your house, with a ha-ha as well, which is a lovely Victorian feature. We'll go and find a bit of shelter a moment, and we'll try to reflect and maybe even try some quick fires on you. Thankfully, we have found some shelter, because that was quite a cutting breeze. It's still March. Anyway, we found shelter, so the quick fires, here we go. What is your first Lakeland memory, Mark?
Honestly, I think I was about 2.5, and it was the hot summer of 1976, and I had this really vague memory of being taken to Felfoot down above Newby Bridge and sort of paddling. still at an age where you didn't wear anything when you went into water.
Fabulous. Well, our latest episode is based at that setting, which is fabulous, with Robert Beale. Anyway, what is your favourite fell?
For me, it's got to be Ill Bell. I can see it from my bedroom window. It's sort of there, like a little point as you look up the Kent Valley. But also, you know, the best day out for me is if I can cycle up Kentmere from here and then run round the Kentmere Horseshoe and back again. Just about finishes me every time. And that is the peak. It's a wonderful spot.
On a long walk or a run, in your case, where do your thoughts wander?
Well, if you're with other people, you know, walking is the best way to chat, isn't it? Conversation flows freely. If there's more than a few of you, so there's a sort of natural kind of movement between one person and the other. But if I'm by myself, you know, there's a lot going on in my life, and I think your brain does, it knits for you. You get back home and you've put a few things straight.
What's the favourite season of the Lakeland year?
I think it has to be May. Now, some Mays are better than others, but, you know, when it's at its best, it is just extraordinary. It's extraordinarily beautiful. The greens are beyond belief. I mean, I lived in London for a long time before coming back home, and you never notice the seasons when you're in a city. You know, around here, just at home, we're blessed with all these incredible trees around us, and just seeing them coming out, it's pure joy.
Everything is coming to life. If you were the Prime Minister for a day, what one thing would you do to safeguard the landscapes of Cumbria?
Am I allowed two?
Oh, you can rub two together. Merge them beautifully.
That is about a younger population and actually where they can live and be sustained and, frankly, attracted. You know, we will always use some of our youth, but we need to steal somebody else's youth back in return. And that's just not... It's sort of just too absent.
And because of the cost of accommodation and everything and public transport, infrastructure isn't there for them to live and work here.
Yeah, so we're going to have to allow some kind of development somewhere to address that because, you know, our communities are going to die. The other thing I think the government really needs to think about, certainly for this area, is over-tourism. And we need a sustainable transport policy and some way to get that funded. That raises heckles amongst people. But we've got to deal with this. We can't just constantly pile more and more people in, you know, tens of millions.
Have you a particularly memorable walk you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, I tell you what I love more than anything in the Lake District is a summer evening fell race. You gather often at a pub or maybe a farm. Piker Bliscoe fell race, I think it was 2017 or 18. Absolutely the most beautiful summer season. You gather, and frankly, you could be 18 or you could be 80. You go out to the top and back. There's usually a pint or two. There's an award ceremony. It is just the warmest, most community kind of event. It's always a highlight of my entire year.
Journey's End, we're back looking out over the meadows, the woodlands, down towards Burneyside. Wow, there's been a lot to fit in today, Mark, but a really inspiring story, this one.
Oh, I loved it. Mark is such an enthusiast. He's one of these people that his mind is never still.
The high-tech stuff that's going on in those factories and seeing it all, I mean, it's incredible what's going on there, to be honest with you. But it was also lovely taking that long step back in time and seeing the artisan business, the crafting of paper with those apprentices. You know, what a lovely thing to be able to give back to this community with a functioning business. You know, absolutely brilliant. It was good to get the reminder that, actually, I think Lee Schofield is now involved with this new massive project, which is going to radically transform the landscapes of what I think we call the Far Eastern Fells. This is incredible stuff on a massive, massive scale.
It's all about this bigger picture of where they are, caring for the landscape in a way that is productive and getting the calorie value, producing their own food, a bit like growing well at Tea Bay and elsewhere.
Housekeeping. This is episode number
121.
For a 120 previous episodes, www.countrystride.co.uk. This podcast continues thanks to the generosity of a small number of our patrons. To be among their number, you can gift us as little as £2 a month. And again, you can find out how to do that at www.countrystride.co.uk. We're on social media, Mark.
Oh, yes, Facebook and Twitter. Oh, I still call it Twitter. At CountryStride1.
Next up, we've had a string of men in the past three or four episodes. Mark, we're going to rectify that. I think the next three episodes, we've got a sterling lineup of fantastic women talking about fantastic subjects. Among the subjects, I believe we're off to Whitehaven to talk about that town. We are going to talk about limestone, I think. Can't wait for that. We've got a lot to look forward to, Mark, and then I think you and I are both going to have a bit of a break, aren't we? So
you're going to actually stride a little bit, but we won't go into that at the moment.
Not right now. Anyway, the sun's come out. Just as we put this to bed, the sun's come out. But there we go. That's a nice day ahead. So we're saying goodbye from today, and we'll see you on next fortnight's Country Stride.